On Business and Economic Development to order. Welcome, beautiful, another spring afternoon. Don't know when winter's going to arrive. We're going to go in reverse order today. And so 413, Senate Bill 600, then Senate Bill 671. So that's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 413. Ms. Van Winkle, you want to give us a brief synopsis and we'll get into this.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, committee member, Senate Bill 413 amends RS 215130 to allow the alteration of a non-conforming electric utility transmission line to increase safety or ensure safety or increase capacity. It may have a fiscal impact. There's no revenue impact. And the Central Oregon Cooperative will be submitting Dash 1 amendments to clarify the intent of the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have another people signed up, including Representative Wisnett. And I'm going to give you courtesy, if you want to come up and testify first, however you want to do that, you're welcome to do so. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Gene Wisnett, District 53, Oregon's year-round rural Deschutes County. And I'm here today to the committee and appreciate the courtesy of coming and speaking to you. And I'm here to oppose this bill. First of all, I'm not opposed and I'm a strong supporter of electric co-ops. I'm a member of Mid-State Electric Co-op, and I think they serve a valuable service in our community. But what we have today, and the reason I'm opposing this bill, is I think we're trying to go around what's already been decided locally in Deschutes County, the Oregon Court of Appeals, and the Land Use Boards of Appeal. I think that we're trying to bypass what's already been decided at the local level, and I think that's in direct contradiction to what Measure 37 said, that we want flexibility. And so this was decided at the local level. I understand what Central Oregon Co-op is trying to do. I think there's some questions, and that was presented and ruled on at the lower levels. So I'm asking the committee to not take action and on this bill. There's other property owners in Central Oregon that are opposed to the bill that were not aware, including Eagle Crest Resort, as reported in the paper today. If the bill is passed, it will negatively impact views and devalue the property. You're going to hear other testimony from the Cyrus family about that, and they have some very good visuals if you'll look at those. Central Oregon is growing quickly, and eventually will need more electricity. However, there are other channels and ways to go about it, and I would encourage this committee to honor those ways and to not approve this bill as it's presented today.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Representative Wisnett? Thank you very much. Let's ask Roger Martin, Al Gonzalez, and Martin Hansen of the Central Electric Co-op to come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the lobbyist for Central Electric Co-op in Redmond, Oregon. With me, my immediate right is Al Gonzalez, who's the general manager. And on his right is Martin Hansen, the legal counsel for Central Electric Co-op. I would like to give you some background, and we will then get into the details of the bill. This bill, House Bill 1413, is a required piece of legislation to make a decision made by this legislature 40-some years ago, whether you're going to enforce one of the main electrical utility laws of the state of Oregon. I refer to ORS 758-400, which was passed in 1961, and it is called the Electric and Gas Utility Allocation of Territories and Customers Statute. It was probably one of the most heated debates of the last half century. I know that because I've talked to the people who lobbied it at that time, including Jack Lansing, who's a former president of Pacific Power and Light, 85 years old, and told me in detail the problems they had going through this. 50 years ago, tremendous fights erupted in this legislature about which electric public or private utility could serve which area. It was finally, peace was finally brought by this allocation law in 1961. The Public Utility Commission spent 4 years traveling around the state explaining to all kinds of groups of people how it would work, and then it was implemented. Part of that requirement is that electric utility, when they're allocated a territory, and Central Electric Co-op was allocated the territory we're going to be talking about, from Redmond to Sisters out to Black Butte. Pacific Power and Light wishes they'd taken the territory because nobody envisioned there would be a Black Butte and all the development that's gone on. But Central Electric took that, and like all utilities in the state, they were required to serve all of the people in that district. They didn't have a choice. You're going to bring service to those people. In 1961, as you'll hear, a 69,000-volt transmission line was built across the territory of the people that are going to object to this bill to serve that area. It is over capacity right now, and Al Gonzalez will tell you the details of that. But just for a moment so you can understand what we're talking about, electrical transmission lines are the larger electrical lines that you're all familiar with, but you may not know by detail. For instance, if you drive to the Portland area, in the Wilsonville area, the I-5 corridor is crossed by two Bonneville lines that are 500,000 volts. The line that runs along I-5 coming south along I-5 from the Portland area is a 230,000-volt line that's owned by Portland General Electric, I believe it might be Bonneville. 115,000-volt line, and that's the subject of this conversation, is a line on a single structure, some 80 to 90 feet in height maximum, and it is required. The reason you do these things is that the higher the voltage, the more energy you can carry. And the 69,000-volt line that presently feeds the Sisters Black Butte area is over capacity. It needs to be replaced, and that's what we're talking about. These kind of lines cannot be put underground. I spent a number of years in the electrical equipment business. Unlike a distribution line, which is the usual kind of line you see through your neighborhood, which can be either overhead or underground, you cannot put a transmission line underground. It must be overhead. And that's what this debate's about. So I'd like to have Al describe for you the reasons for this.
Good afternoon. My name is Al Gonzalez, and I have been the President and Chief Executive Officer of Central Electric Cooperative since 1996. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 413. Central Electric Cooperative was chartered in 1940 and has served the people of Central Oregon since that year. We currently have nearly 30,000 accounts spread over six counties and 5,300 square miles of central and eastern Oregon. Our service territory extends from the crest of the Cascade Mountains to a point nearly 100 miles east of Prineville and from south of Bend to a point 25 miles north of Madras. Central Electric is a private corporation owned by the members we serve and governed by a 9-member board of directors. The directors are elected by the membership residing in 9 distinct geographic districts within our service territory. As you probably know, Central Oregon is one of the fastest growing areas of the state, and Redmond, our headquarters, is the fastest growing town per capita in Oregon. While the largest number of our accounts are in the Bend area, some 15,000, we have nearly 6,000 installed meters in the Sisters, Black Butte, Ranch and Indian Ford area. Interestingly, however, our load, or the total amount of power delivered in the Sisters area, is greater than that of the 15,000 accounts in Bend. This is because there is no natural gas service in the Sisters area, so almost all homes, business, and farms use electric heat. The Sisters area has been growing at almost the same pace as Redmond in the past decade. So about 5 years ago, we began planning for the upgrade of an older, lower voltage transmission line that was built in 1962 and runs from Redmond to Sisters. Currently, the demand for power in Sisters is so great that if the area was hit by severe cold weather, we would not be able to meet the demand with our current transmission lines. To prevent brownouts or blackouts in and around Sisters, we must upgrade the old 1962 transmission line. Since we began planning for the upgrade of this transmission line, the Sisters' growth rate has accelerated beyond our wildest dreams. In just the past 3 weeks, for example, it was announced that a new destination resort will be built on 1,900 acres just west of the Eagle Crest Destination Resort west of Redmond. This new resort, which Central Electric will serve, will be so large that it will require its own substation. It will contain 3 golf courses and 1,000 new homes. Currently, the old transmission line that we hope to upgrade bisects this property upon which the new destination resort will be built. Within days of that announcement, it became public that more than 100 acres in and adjacent to the two downtown sisters will be available for residential and commercial development within the next 2 years. The old transmission line that we hope to upgrade is located on both private land and land owned by the Bureau of Land Management, whose approval we have obtained. There are no public roads in the vicinity of this 11-mile line, except at its western end where it intersects with a county road. In the event we are prevented from upgrading this old transmission line, we will be forced to first ask the City of Sisters to declare a temporary building moratorium pending our ability to provide sufficient and reliable power to the area, and second, to be prepared to execute a series of rolling blackouts in the event of severe weather conditions and or damage to the main transmission line along Highway 126. Finally, we have introduced this legislation with the greatest reluctance. The issue of the need to upgrade the old transmission line has placed us in an adversarial position with one of our oldest members. Given that Central Electric is a member-owned organization, I can assure you its board of directors and its president find this entitlement to use process exceedingly difficult. We believe, however, that our ultimate responsibility lies with the general membership and specifically with the 6,000 accounts in the Sisters area who depend on us for electricity that heats and lights their homes, businesses, and farms. I and our board of directors urge your careful consideration and support of Senate Bill 413. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have before our legal counsel, Mr. Martin Hansen, provides testimony on the events leading up to this hearing.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Gonzalez at this point? Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Martin Hansen, legal counsel for Central Electric Cooperative. This is what brings this issue to your focus is something that's broader than just CEC's territory and our issue. But everything you see in the elements of what we bring to you today is happening across Oregon as our growth increases and as old transmission lines predominantly are in need of replacement and upgrades to meet the growth, both replacement for normal maintenance and upgrading. CEC, like many utility companies, has an exclusive territory. We're obligated under the PUC orders, in this case 1962 order, to provide always safe, adequate power to Sisters, Black Butte, Camp Sherman, all the way up to Hoodoo. And what has happened here on the Jordan Road line, our oldest line, in 1962 it was built to wood transmission line, and it travels across easements, first across the federal government property, which is not at all involved here, because federal government property is not regulated by the states, not regulated by the county, and so they've approved, and this is not the issue. The issue, though, is when we get off into our private easements, like we have with our neighbors that will testify later, we have easements already, land, proper valid land rights to go across and build these lines, maintain them, and expand them. So this is not something that can be addressed in the courts. We have the legal right to do this. Upgrade it, maintain it, and service our customers. And so you would think, where's the problem here? Well, the problem lies in the section of the ORS that's the land use section that we need the revision at, because we are almost the poster child for what other utilities are falling into on a daily basis and will, in the next decade, fall into more often than you can imagine. They need to upgrade a line when land use laws now make that all but, and in this case, actually impossible. And we have gone through every measure that was available, we thought, in the grandfathering section of ORS 215. And I respectfully disagree with our local representative. This was approved locally. When we went through this process, we clearly demonstrated and were approved by the Deschutes County staff that this upgrade was absolutely necessary to provide safe and adequate power, and it was the only way to provide the power. The staff approved it. Went to a hearing when that approval was appealed by our neighbor. The hearings officer approved it, recognized there was a definite need, a definite crisis would ensue, and that this was a lawful easement being used, and just a 40-year transmission line is going to go erased by 10, 15 feet, depending on where you look. So the hearings officer approved it. The Board of County Commissioners were asked to overturn that. The Board of County Commissioners for Deschutes County recognized that their citizens were in dire need of the only utility service available to them for heat, power, and they said, we see no problem. We see that this is not should not be something blocked by land use laws. Only LUBA, and then the Court of Appeals, wrestling with the existing ORS 215, says you can't do it because they said it. You don't meet a lawful requirement because the PUC hasn't specifically come from Salem, driven over the hill, looked at your line, and said, change this pole, this pole, this pole. Until we see that kind of an order, under our interpretation of 215, you can't rebuild it. That's, of course, not going to happen with the PUC. And so they turned us down. We tried then the second grandfathering method, which is we'd already been approved that the upgrade was necessary. The Court of Appeals didn't disturb that. LUBA did not disturb that. They just said that this legal problem in ORS 215 was going to be a hurdle we couldn't cross. So we said we want to alter our nonconforming use, which it was designated nonconforming use and never changed on appeal, that it's a valid nonconforming use, which means it predated land use. We don't think it has any greater adverse impact. Well, we ran afoul there because it had 10 or 15 feet. The Cyruses, who will testify, say it's already in our view. It's been in our view since our grandfather or whoever gave an easement in 1962 to put power lines there to service their farm, which is a legitimate need. We don't want it 5 or 10 feet higher into our skyline, so we lost again. We tried now the only two grandfathering sections of ORS 215, and that's why we bring this to you today. You're likely to hear arguments like, oh, CEC was overbuilding this line, and they're going to try to put some kind of underbuild on this line. Underbuild is underneath the transmission where you could have distribution, you could have other utilities. That's not the case. We put on testimony that was never reversed at LUBA Court of Appeals, that this is purely transmission, and almost the only distribution underbuild here services the Cyruses farm. They're a member. They're entitled to service. They can avail themselves of the 1962 order that requires us to give them safe and adequate power. Ask them about the destination resort that they want to build on their property. That's their right. The land use laws that have allowed the explosive growth in Sisters Black Butte is something they want to avail themselves of their own property. They're not bashful about the fact they want to build a destination resort there. We don't know how we're going to serve that for power unless this transmission line, which goes all the way to Hoodoo and through Camp Sherman and Black Butte, is upgraded, because our evidence was clear and uncontroverted that this line is needed to be upgraded. It's a wooden line that is not able to go from 69 kV to 115, and I'm sorry, we're not in 1962 anymore, either in Salem or certainly in Central Oregon. What we have is this exemption that we're asking for you to pass is consistent with the language of ORS 215, which recognizes health and safety. It recognizes that there's times that a regulatory body like the PUC that is obligated to control a utility, or in this case an electric cooperative, has the right to tell that business you must provide safe and adequate power or safe and adequate service. And there's times that that has to override otherwise compelling land use requirements. And we thought 215 addressed that by the lawful requirement language in there. Well, everybody agreed with us until we got to LUBA in the Court of Appeals, and that didn't avail ourselves. So what we're saying now is we want to be able to, and other utilities are watching us for the same reason. We have an existing transmission line. It's in valid easements that all the property owners have granted. And it needs to be improved so we can continue not only to serve that person, but all the thousands of people that are on the other end of the line. We cannot have the land use laws stop us. We've been 2 years now. We schedule these projects because there are millions of dollars that our members have to fund to continue to keep up with growth and keep up with our PUC requirements. We, you know, have set aside money to build this, and now we're 2 years and we're back at square one because ORS 215 effectively stopped it, even though everybody agrees it's a necessary and unavoidable building project that needs to take place. There's no other way to do it. We have one other transmission line going to this area, that is the Highway 126 line. It's already built to 115 standards. We can't build that one. We need to have a second line, because that's the only reason we got from 1980 until now, was we went down the only right-of-way that gets into Sisters. We utilized that to build that. But now, and you might hear arguments from our neighbors saying, well, why don't they just go through the conditional use process? That's the only application that the co-op hasn't filed. There's a very good reason for that, and our neighbors know that. Their property is one of the reasons. There's surface mining zonings, patchwork quilt along our line, underneath our line. And surface mine zones in Deschutes County do not allow, if you're in the current state of land use. Transmission lines is even a conditional use. And so it's an empty promise to say, oh, go make that application. It'll be turned down at the counter of Deschutes County. We really come here as our last effort to do what the PUC is telling us we have no exception to do, which is to provide safe and adequate power. And we establish it to the staff, to the hearings officer, to the county commissioners of Deschutes County, who know very well what growth looks like. And they know very well what the dangers of brownouts can be, where it's not just blackouts when the lights go off. Brownouts are when fires start in your appliances and other problems. And there's no other source of heat. And when we get to those winters that we have in Central Oregon that everybody enjoys to ski in at 5 and 10 below, Sisters in Black Butte tends to be 15 and 20 below. That means electrical power. And these lines cannot hold it. And they cannot hold it and haven't been able to hold it for a number of years. We're at great risk now with our members in that area. We do not take lightly a request for building moratorium, but absent a revision to the statute that allows the most natural upgrade to be allowed without condition, we're going to be in that situation. We work carefully to get language that was narrow enough that this is not carte blanche overturning of land use laws for any type of business or utility. It's simply transmission lines that are already in existence that needed to be upgraded because of a need for capacity increases. And really, it's the only reason you spend $14 or $15 million of your members' money is if you need to. You don't do it just to gold plate the poles. If you have that, you should be allowed to do that and honor your PUC requirement. This committee has to deal with a balancer. The PUC has a lawful right to tell us to provide safe power when we're the only carrier out there. We are trying to honor that regulatory body's wishes. This statute has gotten in our way, and it needs to be changed so that the PUC's efforts are not thwarted and we don't end up in this crisis situation once again. I'm here for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. I do have a question, just kind of going over your testimony. So you're saying you have these easements and correct for your lines.
Absolutely.
And under law, an easement is a property right.
Absolutely.
So you have a property right.
Absolutely.
And someone is infringing upon your property right that you believe and your mandate to use that easement. Do you see the prospect of... you talked about a building moratorium, or others just aren't going to be receiving power, or they will not be receiving consistent power.
Right.
So you have kind of an emergency and a health issue here, too, obviously, you know, clearly.
Okay.
And you see this as the only way that's going to be achieved.
We have tried and exhausted every land use avenue available to us, literally. We're here after 2 years. Have tried every section of the code other than conditional use, which I told you is impossible, and the county does tell us that it's obvious because of the surface mine zones we go across. Those zoning laws all have come in since 1962. We cannot expand our transmission line.
Yeah, that's one of the questions I'll open up to the committee. Since you have a property right here, have you thought about filing a Measure 37 claim against those folks?
We have contemplated that. That is, again, that's something we don't take lightly as well. That is a band-aid. Given Measure 37, and it's a perfect Measure 37 in this situation, most likely. I'll be candid with the committee. The fact of the matter, though, what happens when we have to rebuild the next transmission line? The Measure 37 is no longer around. After next year, if it goes away, or even this year, if it changes. This, we're here for a permanent fix to a situation that is statewide. And Measure 37 may not meet every time, it may not fit every time. It probably does in this case. But we're looking down the road. Measure 37, everybody can debate what its life cycle is going to be and where it's going to be in a couple of years. But we know that there's going to be growth. We know there's a need for transmission lines, and we need to address that. This co-op does not work on a day-by-day basis. We work on decades down the road projecting. Right now, this has all of a sudden... the need has passed up our long-range planning. This isn't even current planning. We are behind the curve. And Measure 37, with its issues, is not an appropriate, I feel, means of addressing this statewide. And this is not just a private CEC bill. This is a necessary bill for all utilities.
I understand. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you. What were the reasons that Luba gave for not granting it? Because of the way the statute was written? Is that all
yes.
they said?
Well, what they said, no, they were obviously, they wrote an opinion, but the only thing that they didn't disturb any of the lower hearings officer's ruling, with the exception, the hearings officer found that in the current language, that they're under 215, we were building this pursuant to a lawful requirement She agreed with us that there was a lawful requirement. That's the term. It's just that's as vague as it is, lawful requirement. I pointed and gave her and introduced into our exhibits the 1962 PUC order that still is our lawful requirement, safe, adequate power. And PUC said, we agree that you have that requirement. We agree that you have that need. We agree that rebuilding it is the means of doing it. But we think when the legislature passed 215, the term lawful requirement, you have to have a specific order by the PUC telling us, go take the Jordan Road line and upgrade it from 69 to 115 kV. That's where LUBA, I believe, in its interpretation, took a very narrow interpretation, but the Court of Appeals then backed them up and says, yeah, we think that we're going to be cautious here. Does that mean anything other than a lawful requirement? You have to have a specific order. Well, we're never going to get a specific order from the PUC to upgrade Jordan Road until we have a failure. If we have a failure and a crisis, and the City Council of Sisters calls up and says, we just had this co-op, said they're not going to let us build any more houses, then we might get a PUC order, but that's not the way business is done. I hope it's not done in this jurisdiction this way. So that was where it failed. They found that the lawful requirement was not broad enough for this. This addresses that issue.
And just one little follow-up. Yeah. And have you taken this situation to the PUC yet?
Taken? No.
No.
The PUC is not one to give out advisory orders.
Thank you.
So we have not, no.
Other questions?
Yes, Senator. Mr. Chairman, the amendments to the bill, which are
right, the dash ones,
are in front of you and available to anybody that wants a copy of them. That's back here.
Okay, thank you very much,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
You've been appealed to LUBA, and
no. Yes, we were appealed to LUBA, lost at LUBA, and then we appealed it to the Court of Appeals.
And?
Lost at the Court of Appeals on the same issue, the lawful requirement issue.
And that exhausts your legal opportunities? You can't take it to the state Supreme Court or?
You could attempt to, but given the language, I can't in good faith. And that's going to take another year, year and a half. Of course, the Supreme Court only takes 2 to 4% of the cases you put before them. But even if they took this case and you went through another year, year and a half process, the likelihood and that language that the same result would occur is significant enough that we did not take it any further. What we did, because we have a time constraint problem, we then went through the last remaining grandfathering section and applied for that at the county, and that was we had to establish that it was no greater adverse impact by these polls going up, and the hearings officer turned us down there, and I'm not too surprised at that. So we exhausted that. That was a factual determination. So practically, I think if you were the client in the same situation, knowing that there's this, any winter could be the winter of crisis. We're blessed this year to have such a mild winter. I mean, it's going to catch us in the spring probably with not enough rain, but for this co-op, we were dreading cold snaps. We're not going to get lucky every year, and that's why we need a long-term fix.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Has there been other utilities that have run into the similar problem with the way the statute reads?
Well,
that you're aware of?
That I'm aware of specifically, no, I do not. I can't say I can give you a specific citation of another utility that's been turned down the same way. Many utilities we find go out and just rebuild their lines and don't necessarily, this isn't a slam to them, they just feel that they can. Their easements give them the right to maintain, upgrade, and rebuild them. They don't always go and make application. We felt it was necessary for us as good citizens to make an application because to get this confirmed as a non-conforming use, which it was, and go through that process. Some utilities just go out and rebuild them and nobody objects because they understand that power lines need rebuilding. This was an upgrade, so we said, well, let's do it by the book. And we wanted to make certain that this was something that we wouldn't get halfway through the project, get off the BLM land, and have somebody put a stop work order on us. But I can't point to another utility that's run into this, but these facts are not unique to us. Transmission lines, old 1962 transmission lines, are all over this state, and they're all being rebuilt periodically as the growth increases in those areas. And you don't put the old two wooden pole system that we have out there on Jordan Road back. You tend to put a newer, modern, it's going to last longer, be more efficient, and safer. Technology in the utility industry has also improved, and we have to meet national electric safety codes. And that was one thing, I don't know what the neighbors might say, but we submitted the national electric safety code at every hearings body, and we're never, ever challenged with the fact that these poles poles are as low as they can go. There has to be certain separation between the transmission and the distribution underbuild that goes to the neighbor's property. You just can't squish these things down into 30 feet off the ground. The National Electric Safety Code requires there be such a height with such a separation. Nobody challenged that. So that's another area that we're no different than any other utility. All meet the same code. So when you upgrade from 69 kV to 115, you're carrying more capacity. You have to meet those codes. And the poles, even though we engineered it to keep it as low as we could, we were very successful going, in some cases, of 8 or 9 feet higher, at the worst 15 feet higher. But it is higher. In all fairness, it is higher. So if you already have a line across your view, you're going to still have a line across your view. You're actually going to go from two wooden poles to maybe one steel pole. But I don't blame you. It's not perfect world. But in this case, as Mr. Martin indicated, transmission doesn't go underground. There's no way to do it. Our utility system's not geared for it. There's a few areas for transmission in big metropolitan areas that can go underground. It's wildly expensive. It's not even a factor. It's not even possible in our area.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Matt and Keith Cyrus, please.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. I certainly hadn't expected to go into as much detail.
Can you identify?
The bill that was in front of you is kind of like swatting flies with a shotgun.
Please identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. Matt Cyrus, Sisters, Oregon.
Thank you.
Give you a little bit of background that was maybe glossed over a little bit. The transmission line in question was constructed in 1962. It served the Sisters area supplying power till approximately 1980-81 when it was replaced with the transmission line that currently runs down Highway 126. I apologize, I didn't bring enough copies for everyone, but if you'd like, maybe a copy of... In that picture, it shows the Highway 126 transmission line, which Central Electric has represented is designed for a 115 kV capacity. Since that time, in discussions with linemen and other employees of CEC, indication is that the old Jordan line topic of discussion has not actually been used to transmit power. Although it may be energized, it's like an extension cord that's laying there unused. It is not actually transmitting power. So currently all of the power supplying the Sisters area is supplied at 69 kV instead of the designed 115 that's currently going down 126. And the second line that they have into the area is not even in use. So the arguments that they're about to have brownouts and major health and safety issues, they have some other avenues. First of all, they could simply upgrade the 126 to 115 instead of the 69 it's currently operating at. Or they could even turn on the line that they're talking about replacing. The discussion, one of the questions was as far as the lawful requirement. We did some digging into the legislative history of the lawful requirement that they were arguing. They were looking for the lawful requirement argument as a outright avoidance or exemption to having to deal with any land use actions. Their theory was that under lawful requirement, they could be granted outright approval for anything they wanted to do without going through the process. The legislative history and the intent, and in fact that's what Luba agreed with, was as a lawful requirement was reserved for instances such as a person has an office that somehow doesn't meet ADA requirement. You have to go get a building permit to make a change. The county couldn't deny you the ability to make a minor modification to meet another requirement of another entity. That was the purpose behind the lawful requirement argument. It wasn't to avoid land use altogether. With regard to the non-conforming use, they've in order to go the non-conforming use route, they have to show that it doesn't create an additional adverse impact. If, in fact, they were proposing a 5 to 10-foot increase, as the testimony just states, they'd have had it built by now, because we certainly wouldn't have been opposing it. In fact, what they're proposing is more nearly a 50 to 100% increase in height. Rather significant increase. Poles that are 40, 45 feet out of the ground were proposed to be replaced with poles that are, as he just testified, as much as 90 feet high. When they came back the second time around, their newer application, they amended it to lower the pole heights, but they changed the insulator style. The wires were the same height. The poles were just shorter by putting vertical insulators instead of insulators that hung down. So it's more semantics. The overall height was identical, but granted, the poles were shorter then. The CEC is correct in the fact that the hearings officer did agree with them the first time around. They felt that maybe they did meet the lawful requirement and approved the alteration of non-conforming use. However, as they also were correct in stating, LUBA disagreed with the interpretation of both their attorney and with the hearings officer. They appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals upheld LUBA. And on remand, then the county hearings officer, who had better direction, denied their application. And so it's been, hours worth of legal work, testimony, through the hearings officer twice, LUBA, the Court of Appeals. CEC has lost. They have other avenues. What they're proposing is unnecessarily high. For example, the photo that I showed you of the 126 line is much smaller than what they're proposing for as a replacement. They testified that meets the requirement of a 115 kV. Although they're now saying that they're absolutely going with the absolute minimums for the new line they're proposing. We did some research, contacted a number of electrical utility engineers that design utility lines. All of them told us that what their CEC is proposing was unnecessarily high, and that it was designed for a communications underbuild. Although CEC has claimed that they're not, their first exhibit specifically showed an underbuild. The line could be much shorter if it wasn't designed for an underbuild that they're claiming isn't going to happen. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get written testimony from the engineers we spoke with, because their companies all contract with utility companies, and they're afraid of being blacklisted. But, it's kind of, like I said at the beginning, it's kind of like slapping flies with a shotgun. This broad statewide approach to a simple issue that could easily be resolved if CEC was actually willing to sit down and have a serious discussion about what they really need, not just an arrogant attitude of what they want, and, so be it, they're going to do it.
Thank you. Keith, you have some things to add there?
Keith Cyrus and Sisters, members of the committee and chair, Mr. Chairman, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here today and for you taking the time to be bothered with some of these issues. I acquired a property where the majority of this transmission line that's in question goes across 1959. I've tried to be a good neighbor. We gave them an easement across there in 1962 with a verbal understanding, that when the time come that we needed a service to a pump station or something in there, they would provide it. And, I kind of interpreted that, they'll build it. But when it come time, I had to pay for it like everybody else. I thought we'd made a deal, that this was a little trade-off for what I gave, they would give back. And later on, I helped clear the pad where the substation is with with the dozer we had at the time. My uncle actually built some of the equipment, the first substation. So we've been really closely involved and tried to help the community. And you know, there's a lot of negative out there, you know, that we're going to cause a brownout and, you know, Black Butte Ranch is going to suffer and everybody's going to suffer. But, you know, this thing is really an extension cord laying there. And a really good, serious question to ask is, when is the last time that that line in question actually carried any power to anybody beyond the our west property line? There's a switch tower there, and it's available. You know, I watched 2 years ago. It was kind of cold, and I thought, well, maybe here's a chance to test this and kick that extra 69,000 volts in and see, you know, see what's needed. It wasn't needed. It didn't get turned on. So I don't know. The issues are we're trying to reduce the impact on our property. It is a 37 major property. You can imagine going back to 59 what some of our opportunities could be and the impact this line could have. But, you know, we recognize that people need power. We may need more power. Transmission line along Highway 126, you know, is pretty tall, but, you know, it's along the highway. I think their concern is truck might hit it, and it might be down for a couple hours while they replace a pole. But essentially what they're asking for is a duplication of their system to where they can shut the 126 highway line off and still serve everybody from a new line that they propose to build through our property. And I just don't believe it's necessary. You know, and we've looked at some options, and I thought at one point we were very close to coming to an understanding. We suggested a little change in routing that would create a little less impact. One of the poles and one of the photos, I don't know what you have, but, you know, I have a center pivot, irrigation pivot, that goes around and has to stop when it gets to it and go back around the other way. And, you know, I spent about $4,000 to put the reverser and all the equipment on that, you know, to accommodate that. I had a letter in writing from them that they would move that pole years ago, you know, if I went in and put that pivot in. Again, it's one of these things, when it come time for them to perform, it didn't. I mean, we got nowhere. We're still stuck with a pole in the field. So a similar situation along Highway 126. Their right-of-way fellow, he come along and wanted me to give him an easement to move out into my field. And I said, well, stay in your right-of-way. They've got a right-of-way along the highway. Well, we're just going to, like was they mentioned today, you know, when they want to do something, they just do it. I've got poles in my field. They don't have an easement for it. They just put them there. So this is kind of the way we've been treated. So, you know, I kind of started losing patience with all this rhetoric we get. And, you know, the only reason the hearings officer went with them the first time is they were grossly misrepresenting. You know, they kind of picked and choose what they wanted people to hear and know. They didn't tell the whole story. So that's when we went out and took pictures of polls, you know, that represented the true story. And then that's kind of when they started stumbling. And, you know, again, we want to get along. And we've been involved in the community for a long time. I've been over 40 years involved with the fire department as a volunteer. Matt's a volunteer, and he's a first responder, you know. And we've done a lot in the community. And we still like to be treated this way.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Cyrus. Any questions for either Mr. Cyrus?
Thank you very much. We just have one more testimony, and hopefully it'll be short because we're running late here. Mr. Gonzalez is the last one set to testify. I think we're getting a handle on the issue here.
Committee members, Chairman Metzger, I promise I'll be very brief. For the record, my name is J.R. Gonzalez. I am a program manager with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I manage the safety and reliability section, and I'm here to make a statement that from the safety reliability point of view, we do not have any concerns with the bill as presented.
Okay. I have a question for you, though.
Sure.
Your authorities were questioned in the opening testimony that the co-op has a legal responsibility under the PUC, and but is unable to exercise that. Was that a correct assessment? And what the implication was, there was nothing. The PUC had a requirement, but there's nothing that the PUC could actually do to help them meet that requirement. Is that correct?
I think that the statement pertained to the utilities have the obligation to bring service to customers, basically whatever they are, electric service, that is. And with that perspective, anything outside of that, I don't see anything that the commission can do. And my area is safety and reliability, so I may—I do not want to misspeak for anybody. So maybe somebody else from the commission should be addressing that. That
number response. One, number of them are here today for other reasons, but
yeah,
I,
they are.
I,
Commissioner Byers here.
I do have one question, though. This is because I think it's important to understand this. Is that the testimony was that if they have brownouts or they're unable to provide service, you know, now you do have a health and safety issue. Mm-hmm. If just let's just say by fiat, all that stuff was true, and that happened, and that situation occurred. Lines never upgraded, building continues, new resort goes in, no power, or people are at risk. If that were to happen, does the PUC have a role there? What would you do in that case, if anything?
Great question. When you have an issue with lack of power supply to a certain area, the responsibility of the owners usually is on the utility themselves to have proper planning, work with the proper organizations, administrative bodies, and regulatory bodies to address those requirements. And usually the utilities will have a very good perspective on what their load growth is and what certain requirements are. Also, you have to look from a reliability perspective that you have the N-1, N-2 type reliability assessments. And there is the issue. If you have a single feed into an area and you were to lose that and you don't have any other way to back it up, that's it. That has nothing to do with not having the ability to bring power. It has to do with the ability of having a reliable service or redundancy into the system. A blackout situation, I think, and again, from a safety reliability perspective, the commission should take a vested interest in hearing more about it and be able to ask the questions and see where things are.
We're going to move. Yes, Senator Montesanderson.
May not quite be related, but are the poles used for anything else other than transmission?
No, as a matter of fact, with the FCC opening the right-of-way nationwide in the state of Oregon, we've adopted that. Other thatchers can come onto the pole, i.e., you can have a telecommunication, a telephone company, cable company, so on and so forth.
So that could be a concern then. I mean, broadband is so important, so it could broadband, cable,
correct,
telephone.
Yeah, exactly.
Better. Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, Mr. Gonzalez, I would ask, since there's others in the room, you know, hearing, we have redundancy of the PUC in the room, I think the committee would be very interested in the scenarios that were laid out today as to then what roles or responsibilities the PUC would, or actions they might take if any of the scenarios that were brought forward, if nothing happens, if the status quo is maintained, what options or role the PUC would have in a situation like this. I think that would be very, very interesting.
Okay.
You know, this is very interesting subject, more interesting than I thought when I first heard about it. I mean, we've got a utility with a property right who is claiming they're being denied the right to effectively use that property. And you got another owner who granted that right who's saying that these tall poles, you know, interfere with the value of our property. And I think it's kind of apropos and ironic in many ways with this issue that, you know, those issues are important to people and that we need to consider the rights of the other people that we impact. So thank you very much, all of you. And we'll look for the PUC response on that because that's going to be very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 413 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 600. And Teresa.
Mr. Chair, committee member, Senate Bill 600, sponsored by Senator David Nelson, reorganizes and restates telecommunications utility regulation law. It may have a fiscal impact, and there is no revenue impact. There are a set of Dash 1 amendments before you that have been submitted by Senator Nelson, which further enhances the intent of the bill.
Okay, I only have one person signed up to testify, and that's Shelley Jensen of Verizon. Do you want to comment on the previous issue? Surprise, surprise.
Unfortunately, we don't serve that area, so I know nothing.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Shelley Jensen, Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon. This is a pretty straightforward bill. Last summer, the PUC set up a work group of telecommunications providers, and the task was to try and update and reorganize the Section 759, which is the section of the code that deals with telecommunications. The ground rules were basically to try and make it better in terms of more user-friendly and take out some of the things that were clearly outdated, but not to make any major policy changes, because we wanted to get all providers' agreement as well as the PUC's agreement, and we have that. Members of the group included Quest, OTA, Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, Integra, the PUC. There are probably others that I'm omitting, but pretty much competitive carriers, incumbent carriers, PUC staff, pretty much the whole gamut was participated. And so if you have any specific questions, I'd be happy to address them, but it's pretty much status quo and just mostly reorganizing things so that it's easier for folks who aren't familiar with the statute to find things in it.
Okay. Well, I did notice the deletion of some, you know, obsolete language, changing of some of the language. Ms. Jensen, is there any substantive change in the law?
No.
As a result of this?
No.
Any questions for Ms. Jensen? Okay. We will bring that back, since we're just scheduled for public hearing at the moment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else to testify? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 600 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 671. And colleagues, 671 before us today is to begin a discussion on proper authorities for the Public Utility Commission. As you recall, we had a couple of days of hearings in January regarding the PUC, with the focus that we tried to keep on, which is the PUC adequately armed with sufficient tools to protect the public interest in the buying or selling of utilities. There were a number of issues, as you recall, from consumer groups, the PUC themselves, the Building Owners and Managers Association, and others. And what we've done is we put a number of what seemed to be good suggestions into this one bill. Certainly, there's nothing wedded to that. I'm not sure they're all right or wrong, but at least gives us a guideline based on those 2 days of testimony of things we might want to consider. We had posted this bill a couple of times. I was anticipating a decision by the Public Utility Commission, and hasn't happened yet. And so I have given up on predicting when that's going to happen. And because of the deadlines that we have given by the Senate President, I thought that discussion better start now. So if we're to get amendments to this, that we would be prepared at that time. And I've asked Mr. Ron Ekus, former chairman of the Public Utility Commission, to come forward and address not only this issue, but there's also a bill in the committee regarding taxation. And I've asked Mr. Ekus to basically cover that broad spectrum from his perspective of what he thinks, from his experience, we might want to consider, and what's good, bad, or indifferent about some of our suggestions. So welcome, Mr. Ekus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. As the chairman said, he asked me to come here and I think give a perspective on a number of different issues. And I will try to do that both from the perspective of having been a former legislator and being a former commissioner. I'm not here really to substitute my judgment for anybody's in some of the issues that are before the commission or before the legislature, but if I can answer any questions related to some of these issues and perhaps help put some of them in perspective or clarify some of the issues that have been before you, I'll try and do that. I had anticipated talking about three issues. One, taxes. Two, different ownership options for Portland General Electric and some of the implications of each of those, and the CPG, PGE case itself, and specifically its relationship to 671. I thought I'd take them in that order, but if you have a preference of order, I'll do it as you wish, and please feel free to interrupt at any time and ask me questions. But, let me start with the tax issue. I've listened to some of the testimony that the committee's received, and I may in fact be repeating some of the things that people have told you, but I think it's to understand the issue, it does take sort of a sequential discussion. And the first thing to understand is basically how the PUC sets rates. And you know, rates are set to provide a certain revenue stream to cover the costs and provide a reasonable rate of return. Well, included in that is an element of expenses that covers a wide range of expenses. It covers power purchase costs, it covers labor, it covers operation and maintenance, it covers allocation of administrative costs, and it covers taxes. So taxes are one part of the expense component. And generally what happens is the PUC, to determine the tax component that goes into the rates, would do an estimate based on what it considers to be the utility, and I'll specifically talk about PGE to make it simplify it, on what it believes is PGE's liability, tax liability to the state and to the federal government. And that tax liability is related to PGE's provision of the service, the cost of providing service. It is PGE's tax liability, and as I understand it, generally, what's been in rates has coincided fairly closely with what PGE's actual tax liability is for the state and federal government. And it's important to remember that almost all of those expenses that I outlined to you before that go into rates, all of them are going to vary from what's actually used in rates. The rates are set upon a historical test year with adjustments made for known and measurable events in the future. And once the rate is set, the revenues that the utility gets and the expenses that they incur will vary until between the time that rate is set and the next rate is set. But the liability that's in there for PGE has been pretty close, as I understand it. The problem is the liability for PGE is not what is paid in taxes to the state and federal government, because in most cases, recently anyway, it's not PGE that's paying the taxes. It's the parent company that's paying the taxes. And the liability is accurate, but the liability goes up as part of the overall tax computation for the parent company, and the parent files the taxes. In fact, Oregon's tax laws and federal tax laws allow the company to pick and choose. The parent company can pick and choose whether to file an unconsolidated form for PGE or a consolidated form for the parent company based on whatever they think gets them the greatest tax benefit. So while the rates reflect PGE's actual liability, it doesn't reflect what PGE pays, because PGE is not required to be the filing entity in either the state or the federal government. And you have this disconnect between the way rates are set and the way they include taxes and tax laws that allow the filing of taxes to be based to allow the parent company to file the taxes. The second issue then is, well, is the PUC setting, are they doing this right? The PUC's approach, which was the approach when I was a commissioner as well, is standard regulatory approach used throughout most of the country, consistent with standard regulatory principles, consistent with the legal framework for setting regulation. It accomplishes two things. It ties what's in rates directly to the costs and benefits of providing the service. The second thing it does is based on a principle which we put down in more detail in writing when we approved the Enron merger, that the process of doing this based on the standalone basis for PGE, not only for taxes but for other expenses, is designed to protect the ratepayers. We do not want rates to be set based upon the operations of a parent company's unregulated operations and on their unregulated companies. You can have some perverse incentives or perverse situations here. You can have a situation where the company, the parent company, is doing very well. Therefore, its taxes are higher. And you have rates going up to pay for taxes for a company, a parent company, whose other operations are doing very well. I don't think you want that situation. Similarly, it can go either way. And the desire with Enron, particularly, was to protect ratepayers. And that's kind of standard regulatory procedure. The problem is that you end up with this disconnect. So, you know, the questions that people now face is, what are the consequences of this disconnect? Are the consequences of this disconnect so significant that we need to change either the rate-making process or the tax filing? And if so, how do we do that and not create some unintended consequences? Now, let me give you another example, because I'm not sure from what the testimony I heard when you had at your last hearing where you discussed taxes. I'm not sure what impression was left, because I've asked a number of people who were at the hearing what they thought, and I got different answers. Senator Metzger asked, I think that the chairman made a point about, you know, these are the board is supposed to be, or Mr. Kohler pointed out that he thought the board was composed of good businessmen who make good business decisions. And Senator Metzger pursued the issue of the tax filing and whether this was a DOA. I think the term net fleece was the term that you creatively used. And asked whether or not the company, PGE, asked Mr. Kohler whether or not PGE intended to file a unconsolidated return. The answer may have been sort of confusing. I think at least the testimony I heard of Bob Jenks cleared it up, but I thought I'd go over it a little more so we could make sure that there's an understanding of this. What Mr. Kohler said was that Oregon Electric would be an Oregon company, PGE would be an Oregon company under ownership of Oregon Electric holding company, that therefore, since PGE was the only operating entity that Oregon Electric had, taxes would be paid to Oregon. And I think that that's true. Under that scenario, taxes are going to be paid to Oregon, maybe more taxes than were paid when Enron was the parent company. But you still have the issue of who's filing the taxes and who's getting the benefits. As it was described in the hearing, Oregon Electric, as the consolidated entity, is filing the taxes, not Portland General Electric. Unless, of course, Oregon Electric decides that an unconsolidated filing by PGE would actually benefit them more. And what you have is entities that have two different capital structures. When the commission sets rates, any regulatory commission that sets rates, Oregon or anyone throughout the country, is going to be concerned about the level of debt versus equity in the company. And there are generally limits about how high or low you can go in the ratio of either one. Portland General Electric, as I understand it, has about 53% equity. Oregon Electric, on the other hand, has debt of about 80%. So rates are set on an assumption for PGE of 53% equity, 47% debt. And that's pretty good. This company, if it was not in Enron's control and not associated with Enron, would look pretty good, I think, to the financial market that looks at utilities. But Oregon Electric has 80% debt, has interest on that debt, and when it files a consolidated basis, it is deducting the interest on that debt, which is far higher than what PGE has itself and what is included in rates. So what you have, and I think was estimated about $15 million total state and federal difference, if Oregon Electric files as opposed to PGE files. And what that means is that there's $15 million that is included in rates for taxes that ratepayers are paying. It simply bypasses both the state and the federal government and goes directly to the stockholders by virtue of the ability for Oregon Electric to choose to file in a consolidated form. So while Mr. Kohler was correct in saying that Oregon Electric will be filing Oregon taxes and paying their due tax, their the amount of taxes that they owe in Oregon, that's true. But it does not mean either it does not mean that what's in rates is going to match what Oregon Electric pays, nor does it mean that the state will get the same amount of money as if PGE was filing. And I asked several people if PGE said they were going to file an unconsolidated form, and I got yes answers, and that's not what was said. What was said is that Oregon Electric was going to file a consolidated form, and the result of that is this $15 million, and it's pretty well known. I mean, it's known in the rate case. It's admitted. It's planned. It's part of the calculation of Oregon Electric. And it's an example of how even if you don't have a parent company that's with broad operations in different fields and in different states, the tax laws still allow them to pay taxes in Oregon and the federal government that are different than what might be included in rates. That doesn't mean that what's being included in rates is wrong, because it's still consistent with that policy of rates being set based on the operations of Portland General Electric to provide electric service to the customers. So I think the issue becomes, okay, this may not be tolerable. There's two options. One option is to try and change the way the commission sets rates to try and get a better match between what's in rates for taxes and what's actually paid for taxes. And the other is that you look at what the state laws are for filing and whether or not the amount of money that's being diverted from rates to the stockholders instead of going through the state is significant enough that that's worth changing. The only way to get closer to a match and to get the state money is to change the tax laws. But let me first deal with the options that the commission has. And the commission's done a white paper, which has at least begun the process of looking at the options. And let me say here, I think the commission is well grounded in sound policy of its approach. I think if the commission had erred in anything, it erred in maybe not trying to explain the complexities of this tax issue to start with and thinking that it might be too complex for people to understand, and to maybe not starting a process for addressing it a couple years ago when it started to come up. But they've started to do that now, and we're finding out is that there are some options available, but each one of those has some unintended consequences or maybe not so obvious consequences. And one of the things that people think would be the most simple and obvious resolution is to just do a annual true-up. But the annual true-up has some consequences. And I'm sorry, Senator Walker, the actual approach that's in the bill, if it's intended to be a true-up, I'm not sure will work, because it has to do with IRS tax laws, and I think the PUC white paper goes into this, but the IRS allows normalization of depreciation, which enables it, the benefits of accelerated depreciation spread out over time. And what happens is in the early part of that, there's a difference between the book value and there's a difference between what's filed in the, for taxes. And what happens is that the benefits of the accelerated depreciation accrue to the customers at the end of the booked straight line depreciation. And if you do a true up, it's a good chance you'll lose the IRS normalization and you'll be foregoing those benefits at the end, those benefits that have already been accrued, that are accruing for ratepayers but haven't yet been passed on in rates. And I think that's why within the regulatory community, utilities are regulated, and you find most people thinking that the true-up just isn't going to work because it's going to forgo some benefits that have been building up but not passed on yet. So then you have to look at some of these other options, which the commission is doing, and I think there's a few considerations, and one of them, I think the AG's office said, the legal consideration is whatever you end up with somehow needs to be directly tied to the actual costs of providing services. The other consideration is whether or not whatever is done somehow does something to this valuable IRS normalization rules and foregoes benefits. I am not here to recommend any one of those particular options. I think a potential approach would be one to encourage the PUC to proceed with and finish its investigation as soon as possible and make recommendations, and to let the legislature know if those recommendations require any legislative changes. The second is, I think we are all, in all this buzzing around this tax issue, we are all short of some critical information. I'm not sure, other than with Enron, that we know and understand, one, whether or not this is just a short, we don't know what the impact of this disconnect and misalignment is. We don't really have numbers that tell us how much are the energy utilities actually paying in their consolidated filings or in their filings at all versus what's actually in rates. We don't know what the difference is between the consolidated filing and what would have happened if they would have filed an unconsolidated basis. Until we get some numbers to know that, we don't really know whether we're dealing with sort of a short-term Enron phenomenon or not. We do know in the TPG case, we can easily see how even if it's not an Enron-type parent country, the tax laws can be manipulated to take money directly from ratepayers to the stockholders. And I know the board the proposed board of Oregon Electric PGE is there to supposedly protect and take the interests of the community in heart, but I think, as Mr. Kohler said, they're good businessmen who make good business decisions, and if you can skim $15 million from the state and put it in your own pocket, that's probably a good business decision. So I think some hard questions need to be asked to the Department of Revenue, because we need to get our hands around this impact to see whether or not it's worth looking at requiring changing the tax laws on filing by the companies, whether they should be required to file an unconsolidated return. Now, it would admittedly only affect Oregon, a portion of that $15 million or whatever. But at least it would be a closer match, and at least the state would be getting money that it's not otherwise getting, that ratepayers are actually paying for in rates. The questions that I would ask are, you know, how much, pick a period of time, last 10 years or so. Ask the companies how many times their consolidated filing has exceeded or been less than what was in rates. And we're assuming here that rates are fairly representative of the actual tax liability. Ask the Department of Revenue for some data specific to the utility companies, to the energy companies, so that you can determine the difference between the consolidated filings and what it might otherwise be. I have heard Department of Revenue say, well, you know, the state overall does better off consolidated filings. We're not talking about the state overall. We're talking about utilities who are monopolies who have their rates set on a basis that must include recovery expenses for taxes. And I think we need to know the answers to those questions. I know that the utility companies are probably, and they're going to come in and they're say, no, the existing system's fine. They're going to say it's in sound legal tax regulatory policy. Makes sense. There's no need to change it. They might raise the issue of we shouldn't be treated differently than any of the other corporate tax entities. But the fact is they are different because they're regulated and because there's a whole body of law and a whole body of court decisions that tell the regulator this tax liability has to be included in rates. And we simply need that information. And if there's restrictions on what the Department of Revenue can actually disclose, do it in aggregate, whatever. But I think the state needs to know, because this ability to file the consolidated is not just apply to PGE Enron or Oregon Electric Enron. We need to know what's the scope here, because that I think will help direct and determine which avenues to take and what some of the impact might be of some alternatives.
Mr. Ekus, that is very helpful. I'm going to ask you to do one thing, though, because I'm watching the clock and I have my other panels coming up. I'm going to ask if we can move ahead now to, we're going to skip item two for now, you know, the options, because I don't want to really get into that. And members, we have a tax bill that's not posted today, so I don't want to, I only asked Mr. Ekus to talk about that issue because of his availability today. So with our other panels, I want to focus on the other elements of 671 today. We'll talk about the other one. Mr. Ekus was available today, so I wanted to get that from him. If you could move to the third item, which is that some of the elements that we put in 671 as a result of that hearing and give us a brief overview of what do you think is good, bad, different, and why, that would be helpful, and then we'll move on to some of the other comments.
Well, I think generally it's good to try and put the net benefit standard into the law. It's good for a couple of reasons. One, the law before simply said in the public interest, and I remember the Public Utility Commission, we always have every case we have an argument. Well, does this mean no harm or does it mean net benefit? And the commission looked at, would generally took an approach of we're going to look at each individual case and make the decision. But they finally did issue an order where they essentially said that we think in the public interest means net benefit. And I think it's worthwhile putting that into the law. And the reason is because I think that simply no harm is just not sufficient. You ought to be able to come out of a merger with some benefits to the ratepayer. Otherwise, why do it? You ought to be able to come out with the company that's buying it taking some of the risk rather than simply saying everything's even. So it's approved. You've essentially lowered the threshold. You've essentially, Frank, you've lost some leverage. The merger case is the one point in which you can make sure that the company itself is taking some risk. Well, why would you do that? Well, you do that because you want to make sure that the company does things that are in the benefit of the customers. And you don't really have that guarantee. Now, the commission order recognized that net benefits is not necessarily an obvious thing. there are things that are quantifiable, and you can argue over the numbers and come up with some quantifiable numbers to offset harm and benefit and come up with a net there. And then there's some other things that are very subjective. It's qualitative. You have to make subjective judgments. I think the two things that are important are, one, that is clearly a net benefit standard that goes beyond simply no harm. And two, the commission has a wide range of discretion in trying to assess and determine net benefits, specifically because some things are not easily quantifiable. The other thing I'd mention about the bill is there, in just my looking at it, there's the event, there's the language about additional profits being considered. It's not clear to me exactly what that means. I think there's two things you want to make sure of, either through the regulatory process or the legislative process. You need to ask the PUC whether or not they believe they actually have the authority to get information at the next level, not at the Oregon Electric level, which I think they believe they have authority to do, but do they believe they have the authority, adequate authority, to go up to the TPG level to exercise their regulatory responsibilities. If they don't, and particularly if PUCA is repealed, you may want to shore that up. Mm-hmm. Because if PUCA is repealed, it really the argument for repealing PUCA is that the states can do this, but states can only do it to the extent that they've got the legal authority given them. And Oregon has some of the strongest affiliated interest laws, but those are always subject to change. The other issue about the profits, in addition to sort of getting an understanding of what it is, and I'm sure that your hearings, what's being targeted here, I'm sure your hearings will address that, is I think you have to balance out what it is that how that fits into the calculation of net benefits with what it does to a case to throw things. You may end up be throwing things open so broadly through the additional profits discussion, they've really changed the nature of the merger discussion and diverted it into a whole lot, far too many hypotheticals or far too many subjective judgments or too many things that the commission does not really have, the commission or any other party in the case doesn't really have the ability to get enough information to really make a good case on. The final thing I want to say, and this is in the context of the commission's discretion, is that because there's so much sometimes qualitative, subjective stuff, the things that we want to make sure that people have the opportunity to raise those issues without too narrow a requirement that you have of how concrete and quantifiable things have to be, because some things simply aren't. And there's some things you can't anticipate. Two of my experiences is when we did a price cap, 5-year price cap for U.S. West, we unfortunately made the mistake of trusting them and believing them. And we did not build in requirements for certain customer service requirements because they told us and we believed that they would modernize, that it was in their interest to modernize, and why would they not invest money to modernize in their system? And unanticipated, not really talked about, we found ourselves in a situation where they didn't do that. Service quality went down. In Enron's case, which I sat in, we covered a lot of grounds. We built in a model for other states on how to ring-fence ratepayers from events like the bankruptcy, but I can tell you that we never really considered the possibility that Enron would actually go bankrupt. We were more concerned about the implication of their operations, plus or minus, on the ratepayers and trying to protect them, but bankruptcy wasn't one of the contingencies we thought of.
Thank you, Mr. Ekus. Questions for Mr. Ekus? Okay. It was a very good overview. Thank you very much. It was very helpful. Let's have Kevin Lynch and Catherine McDowell and PacifiCorp and Gary Bauer from Northwest Natural come forward. I have a funny feeling they're against, but they marked the line between for and against, you know, kind of like a state agency. So this is our way of saying we're kind of against it, but we really don't want to go on record being against it. Welcome.
Thank you.
I don't know how you plan to divvy this up, so just go ahead.
All right.
Mr. Lynch.
For the record, Chair Metzger and members of the committee, I'm Kevin Lynch, Vice President of Government Affairs for Pacific Corp, and I have with me today Gary Bauer from Northwest Natural and our counsel for both companies, Catherine McDowell from the Stoll Reeves Law Firm. We've submitted a written statement for the committee's benefit that reflects testimony for both companies, and I'll try to summarize it for you, recognizing the time is a bit of a premium right now. As you mentioned earlier today, this committee held two oversight hearings in January around the question of whether the commission has the power and the authority it needs to fulfill its mission to regulate utilities so customers are assured of receiving safe and reliable services at reasonable prices. Our companies generally believe the answer to that question is yes, they have it now. There may be a little bit of room for improvement in some of the things in the one or two things in the bill that you've proposed. There may be some room to work with those things. As we understand the bill, as we've tried to read it since it was introduced, we broke it down into what we think are four component parts, four policy areas, and I'll try to touch on each one of them. First of all is the net benefit standard that former Commissioner Ekus just mentioned. And I think in general we can support inserting a net benefit standard into the law for situations where there's a true change in control in the public utility. And what I mean by that is that there are a lot of filings that are undertaken under Section ORS 757.511. Not all of them are things that really are a true change in control, a change in ownership. Sometimes there are internal restructurings that corporations do and other kinds of things. I don't think we would want to have a requirement that there be a net benefit for customers every time a filing under 757.511 is sought. That would probably create a pretty difficult standard, and we think we could probably target what you're trying to get at with a bit more specificity with the language than that which is proposed in the bill as it's introduced. So that was item number one. Item number two, with respect to the requirement that in all filings there be projections of anticipated earnings in utility mergers and acquisitions, that's not really something that we can support. Right now it's a matter of common practice in utility mergers that as we go through the process, which takes the better part of a year in most cases, that requests for that kind of information from the acquiring company are made by parties in the case, and the applicant, I think pretty uniformly in the recent past, has provided that information. Under certain conditions, it's provided. So there is an understanding among the parties and the commission about the diligence that the applicant has undertaken and the projections of earnings that may result from the acquisition, and those things become part of the negotiation over trying to either reach a settlement or adjudicate the merger application. So that actually, it happens now, and it's probably not necessary to codify it in statute. There's an additional concern, though, which is, and it's not clear from the language in the bill, as to whether this would require a public filing of all of that information. And if so, that would be somewhat troubling to us to mandate that. I know that the committee has heard some testimony in its prior hearings about the ability and the record of the commission to balance the interests of protecting commercially sensitive information against the public's right to know, and to the degree that that is a concern of some parties in proceedings like this, it's probably not the best way to solve the problem by mandating public disclosure of it, because there are cases where there is information that rightfully on the part of the applicants in a merger is important to protect from broad public view. There are also some things that exist in the financial reporting and accounting world these days, and that are emerging. The emerging standardization of accounting principles across the U.S. and other countries, and other things that may cause unanticipated consequences if we put a requirement like this into law. Those kinds of other statutes and regulations may cause conflicts with this if this is a requirement in Oregon law. Third component of the bill, with respect to the affiliated interest language, I think it's the bottom of page one and the top of page two, we weren't really clear as to what the intent of that language was, and we were concerned about some consequences of it that might arise. The definitions of affiliated interest that are dropped, as I understand it, from this language, with respect to who would be able to acquire control over a utility, may really broaden the requirements of any company to file things with the commission for approval. Anybody who could acquire the ability to exercise indirect or direct control over decisions of the utility, that's a pretty broad definition. For example, if the utility or its parent company wanted to appoint a new member to its board of directors, it might appear to us that under this language we would have to come to the commission to get approval for that. It seems to me to us to be the province of the shareholders, the owners of the utility, to appoint its directors and not its regulators. So maybe with a better understanding of the intent of that language, we could figure out where it's really trying to go and what might work and what might not. But at this point, it seems to cast a pretty broad net, and we'd be very concerned about it. Final issue is with respect to the new sort of oversight and remedial powers that are given to the commission after a merger order is issued. We think this language is generally unnecessary and perhaps overreaching as well. You know, right now the commission has substantial authority to police energy utilities under both merger conditions, under ongoing law and regulation. Let me just tick off a couple of things that it can do right now. Any transaction involving an affiliated interest of a utility has to be brought to the commission before it's undertaken for pre-approval. There are annual filings that we do that are the results of our operations. We show the commission how we did, what we spent, what we earned every year, and there is unlimited access to the utility's books and records, and they are regularly audited. There are, as Commissioner Ekus mentioned, with the Enron PGE merger, with the Scottish Power Pacific Corp merger, there is substantial ring fencing of the finances of the utility from the parent and its affiliates so that the finances of the utility are well protected and the customers consequently are as well. There's enforcement of safety and reliability standards. There's oversight of electric resource procurement. Whenever we go out to buy or build a new power plant, the commission has the ability to see how we conduct our procurement and rules on the decisions that we make. Obviously, they're general rate cases, and there are requirements that we maintain certain debt equity ratios, a certain capital structure to ensure the health of the utility. From a legal standpoint, we think this is a problematic issue. Not only do we think it probably isn't necessary to add this language, but also legally, businesses act on the orders of governments and rely on them to continue to do their business. And the ability of the commission to revoke approval of a merger under this language without any limitation of time, and simply because of on the basis of a finding that the utility or its parent did not act in the public interest, is pretty broad and pretty far-reaching. And I think it would, if it was adopted and ever attempted to be implemented, would really create a substantial legal mess. So we don't think that language is really appropriate in here, and would urge that the committee not adopt it. I think that pretty much concludes my testimony on the four major parts of the bill, and happy to answer any questions.
Let's ask our other two people for their comments, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural, and our comments are combined with the comments Mr. Lynch just gave. I will make a couple of quick general observations. In addition to the list that Mr. Lynch just gave you on authority of the commission, just to share with you, we do file annually a purchase gas adjustment, which basically we take to the commission, show them all of our purchasing of gas. In that process, they also do an annual earnings review. So they go back and they look at the profitability and those things. And then just kind of a general comment on previous PUC proceedings on mergers and acquisitions. And we think the process has probably generally worked fairly well. I think, as former Commissioner Ika said, the commission needs to have some flexibility. Each case is different. You need to be able to look at those and address whatever you think the situation is at the time. You won't always be able to guess on what else might happen. But we think the process has worked. The discussion most recently has been around a more specific type of company that's looking at buying a utility. And again, our concern, as Mr. Lynch has pointed out, is that as you adopt new rules or new legislation, you're going to pick up some of the day-to-day operations that we have. We're not part of the merger and acquisition activity that's in front of the commission right now, but some of these changes very well could affect our day-to-day operations, and that's some of our concerns. Thank you.
Catherine McDowell from the Stoll Reeves Law Firm here on behalf of both companies. The companies asked me to come down so I'd be available to answer any questions you have. This is obviously a technical, legal matter, so to the extent you have any questions, I'm available to answer them. Thank you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Questions for the committee? Senator Walker, you have a question?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And thank you for allowing me to sit in. Mr. Lynch, you mentioned that the PUC has oversight of resource procurement and those sorts of things. But the one thing the PUC does not have oversight on is the type or the type of equipment that you buy or what the expense of the equipment is. You make those decisions yourself, do you not?
Chair Metzger, Senator Walker, generally speaking, we make the specific decisions following guidelines for procurement. Again, this is on the generation side of our business, following procurement rules that the commission has in place, and then we make a decision, we implement it, and we bring those decisions back to the commission for the inclusion of the capital and operating costs of them into our rate base and our rates. And that's the point at which the commission actually has the ability to rule whether we made a prudent decision.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up. But you would agree, wouldn't you, Mr. Lynch, that it's really a better opportunity for you to get that equipment into your regulated rates, because if you buy expensive equipment, there's more of a rate of return and you get like a regular paycheck on that. Is that not true?
Chair Metzger, Senator Walker, I don't think that's true, because the commission has the power to disallow those costs if they find that they were not a decision. A reasonable utility would have made it, would not have made that decision because the costs were excessive. Then those costs would be disallowed, or a portion of those costs would be disallowed and would actually serve as a drag on our earnings. So I think it's a process that has worked pretty well and doesn't tend to build rate base.
I'll leave that one.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Okay, our last two folks for today is Jason Eisdorfer and Bill Linden. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Chairman Metzger, members of the committee. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, attorney with the Citizens Utility Board. We think that Senate Bill 671 is a timely review of the Commission's authority to examine attempts to acquire or merge with energy utilities. In any other 10-year period, I think someone in my position would be lucky or unlucky, I suppose, to be involved with one 757511 proceeding. In my 10 years at Cub, I've been involved with five. That's because the energy world has changed and is changing. And so a review of the Commission's authority under 757511, I think, is entirely appropriate. I'm going to mention three sections of the bill and support them and explain what I think they mean, and then identify two additional areas where the committee might examine additional language. Within the existing language of 671. The first issue, I think, is statutorily stating the net benefits test, I think, is enormously helpful. I think the committee knows that in 2001, the commission, in order 01-778, interpreted 757511 to include the net benefit for utility customers and the no harm for the public generally, and Senate Bill 671 simply verifies that interpretation and adds it to the statute, and that is helpful in our mind. Second, the bill attempts to handle a frustration that we have felt, and that is once the an application is approved, the commission has lost all its leverage. So how does the Public Utility Commission hold the new owner to the commissions that were part of the approval? Section 5.4b would allow the commission to go through the circuit court to seek to prevent the utility from acting in a way that is not in the public interest, and that is valuable. I think Mr. Lynch then referred to the other language in that section that would allow the commission to revoke the 757511 approval. And while that is the ultimate in maintaining leverage, it is not clear what issues this may implicate. And we might suggest instead that in addition to the PUC seeking an injunction that the to the circuit court, that the commission also be able to seek performance of merger or acquisition conditions through the state courts. The commission does have some authority through its regulatory process to make sure that those acquisition conditions are met, but certainly having the additional ability to go and seek performance of those conditions through the state courts, I think, is a valuable option for the commission. The third section of the existing statute I would mention is section 2, paragraph 3, which in our mind makes it clear that the commission can compare the anticipated profits with the potential liabilities and risks of the deal. And this is a very practical issue given what we have just been through. And let me give you a specific example of it. In the Texas Pacific application, we argue that while that docket may not be the right place to change the PUC tax policy, we did recognize, as Commissioner Ickes mentioned, that the structure of the deal that Texas Pacific put together would essentially overcollect from customers about $15 million in taxes per year. What we argued that in that case was that the commission ought to look at that $75 million overpayment and compare it to the $43 million in rate benefit as part of the net benefits examination. And so that by requiring that there be a look at the anticipated profits, which includes these taxes, as part of the 757511 process, I think the commission clearly would be able to weigh the $75 million we're paying versus the $43 million that we may be getting and use that as part of the net benefits. The two areas I would just mention fairly briefly that might warrant some further examination are the same two that Commissioner Ickes mentioned. And I find myself agreeing with Commissioner Ickes more now that he's off the commission than when he was on it. Somehow when you leave the commission, you get much smarter. The first has to do with...
The perspective gets much better, one of the two, I think Ron might say.
Okay. The first has to do with the commission's ability to examine the potential risks as a result of the new ownership during the review of the application. One argument that was put forth by the applicant in the current case before the commission was that the risks and the liabilities that the various parties identified were speculative and unquantifiable, and therefore the commission could not rely on those assertions of risk and liabilities as a matter of fact in their order. The problem, of course, is that any and all risks identified in those applications can't be quantified and can't be certain until such time as the PUC approves the application, and then those risks come to pass, and it's largely too late to do anything about it. It depends upon, frankly, how the order comes out. If the commission handles the identification of risks as too uncertain and speculative, it largely eviscerates the 757-511 review. And the PUC routinely mixes issues of fact and policy. That's why they are a special agency over there. And so one of the things that we think that Senate Bill 671 could do would be to clearly state that the PUC may take into consideration the likelihood and impact of potential risks and liabilities due to the proposed purchase, which are unquantifiable at the time of the application. The other issue that Ron Eek has mentioned that I also had on my list was making sure that it's clear that the commission has the authority to access information, not just at the regulated utility, not just at their parent, but potentially at their parent's parent, at any level where influence is exercised with regard to the regulated utility.
Can I just interrupt for a moment?
Sure.
The language that we've attempted to do with that, does that not get to that at all, that issue, in terms of being able to get that type of information?
Chairman Metzger, it wasn't clear to me. It wasn't clear to me that it did get to that. But that's something that I think that would be quite important. And something else that Ron Eek has said, which is we, depending upon whether the Public Utility Holding Company Act is repealed by Congress, the PUC really is the primary protector of utility customer interests and being able to access information, not just at the regulated utility level, but wherever influence is exercised above the utility, I think is increasingly important. So let me just end by saying that Senate Bill 671 is very timely. In a matter of days, we think we'll get an opportunity to see how the PUC does with the law that is currently on the books, and will give us insight into whether that law and this PUC can protect customers now or after the repeal of PUCA. And so I would urge the committee to keep this bill open until we see how well the current law is working.
Thank you very much. Mr. Linden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Linden, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities, and here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 671. In particular, a few points. The inclusion of the net benefit standard, we think, is very important. It's true that the Commission has adopted that standard and used that standard in these acquisitions, but parties still continue to argue that the no harm standard is the more appropriate one, and we think putting that in statute is an important step forward. Section 5, subsection 4B, on the enforceability of conditions that may be imposed by the Commission is a very important element in our view. The Public Utility Commission needs to have the authority to enforce the conditions they impose, and this clearly will move us well in that direction. Two suggestions we'd like you to consider for possible changes. Section 2, subsection 4, retains the requirement that the Commission act on an application within 19 business days. We are all aware that this bears no real relationship to the time that's needed to adequately investigate applications under this statute. So I would ask you to consider deleting that 19-day requirement. And also, we would like to see the requirements of the net benefit test in Section 2 be clarified to provide that they have to be met upon the effective date of the proposed acquisition, so that there's some certainty that customers are going to benefit from new ownership upon the ownership change as opposed to some point in the future. Mm-hmm. And I know that ICNEW's executive director, Ken Cannon, and his council would be more than happy to work on some language that might get us to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, I would be happy to entertain any questions.
Okay. Thank you both. I think I understand all those issues, especially the latter one. You're obviously be concerned about some benefits that might be accrued but not inured until the fourth or fifth year, and then maybe somebody sells it in the third year, and that type of, I think that's what you're trying to get at.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what we're concerned about, is that the more definite the period of time within which the benefits are realized, mm-hmm. the better for the ratepayers.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for either of these individuals? Okay, thank you very much. Members, what we're going to do is we've got a kind of a little overview here and got some thought on this. I'm going to ask all the parties who had the comments today to please contact Ms. Van Winkle about those types of suggested changes. We will have this bill back. We will, as soon as we get the recommendation from the Public Utility Commission on how they're going to treat taxes, then we will bring that issue up with that piece of legislation. We've given them the courtesy of making their recommendation first, and I told Chairman Beyer that I'd like to have that very quickly so that we can move on. So I know he has a lot of things on his plate. So thank you very much, committee. I think this has been helpful. I think this is an important issue that for the course of this legislature is run, that hopefully we'll be able to do some things that will help in this arena. So with that, we are adjourned.